I want to see the plans on paper for every one of these camps that are along the rivers. And by the way, I'm talking not only about Kerrville now. I want to know about the rivers on the Llano River. I want to know about rivers in North Texas. If we have camps where you take your children and you entrust them to care and assume that a week later they'll be given back to you alive, if that's the case, if there are camps where we don't have emergency action plans, that is negligence.
Hey, y'all. This is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Yolitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey, everybody, thanks for being back with us for another episode of Yolitics this week. Whether you are watching us or listening to us, we're always glad to have you here. And Jason Wheeler here. We have an important episode for you this time. We think they're all important, of course. We tackle a lot of big subjects here, but this one has that extra gravity. Of course, we are talking about the flooding in Central Texas this week. I think we've all been watching in horror and sadness as the week has gone, just at the loss of life there, the number who are still missing there, the enormous response to try to locate those missing and to save people. It really has been a tough week here in Texas, and a lot of tough questions have been asked here in Texas. Unfortunately, we still are awaiting a lot of answers here as well. And so we wanted to talk this week about what happens next, what happens from here. And one of the people that we're talking to in this episode is Chris Lawrence, who has been reporting down in Central Texas for WFAA-TV through the week. And he has some real insight here, I think. He's sharing some of the stories that stayed with him after his time down in that area. And he's also bringing up, I think, some really smart thoughts about things that we should be keeping in mind as we go forward from here. But we want to start off this episode with meteorologist Troy Kimmel. You may recognize that name. He has been around a very long time here in Texas, many decades of weather forecasting and sharing vital information with viewers to help keep them safe and listeners as well over the years. And Troy has a lot of thoughts about this. We just had him on the podcast recently, and we wanted to bring him back here because so much has been said about the response in all of this. From emergency responders and from emergency management and from weather forecasters. And Troy has sort of been in all of those different areas. And so I think he's got some really smart things that he's talking about this time, including the answers he is still seeking. And so we start with Troy Kimmel.
So, Troy, thanks so much for taking the time with us. I know that these are difficult times. I know you've been extremely busy this week. Can we just start off by talking to you about what you have been doing this week?
Well, I mean, this all started, back in the last week or in the last 7 days, back around the 4th of July holiday. And frankly, going into that, Jason, we've talked about you and I, we spent a lot of time talking about the fact that meteorology is an inexact science as far as weather forecasting is concerned. I think it's real important for people to understand that. It's not that I'm trying to get out from underneath anything, but I will tell you that in my time, of which some of that time I spent with Jason here in Austin at TV stations and so forth, the last week has probably been the most difficult for me as far as forecasting. For some reason, the atmosphere, Mother Nature just hasn't been in the mood very much to necessarily telegraph to us exactly what's going on. It's been hard for forecasters to do that. And what I found in many cases, and if you step back into your weather office, this is probably not something we should be doing, but more than a few times in the last week, I've just have to look at radar to try to forecast. In some cases, some of the short range, high resolution model guidance has simply not been helpful. I would say it's been worse than that, but I'll keep it clean. Some of it's been helpful, some of it's not. And it's just been very, very difficult. And then we get into these situations where we have tremendous amounts of rain over a relatively short period of time. Where is it, Jason? It's over the Flash Flood Alley of Texas, which is well known. because of the hills, because of the subsoil limestone layers, and because of the urbanization that's occurring in those areas. People say, well, these flash floods, Jason, are they becoming more frequent because of climate change? And I'm not sure they have. I'm not an expert on climate change, but I tell you they are because of urbanization and growth. We're putting down asphalt. We're putting down concrete in areas where formerly soil had some hope of soaking up some of this water. And guess what? Asphalt and concrete does not have the patience for that. It's all going to run off.
It races to the river. Troy, let me take you back a half a step here, though. You've been doing this a very long time, more than 40 years now, and you're saying that this past week has been the most difficult or one of the most difficult you've had as far as forecasting the weather.
Right. It is. It has absolutely been that. I will also tell you that, as I think we talked about in our previous contact, is that the men and women that hit the buttons for these flash flood warnings at the Austin San Antonio National Weather Service, who I think did an excellent job. And I will argue vehemently with people who will oppose me on that, because I know the people who hit the buttons, they've really done a very good job. Hmm. Is there improvement that Troy Kimmel can make, or for Jason to make, or for the Weather Service to make in the future? Absolutely. We try to improve ourselves, but I'm telling you, they did a good job. They did what was expected of them. And I think that's so important for people to realize. And now we find ourselves where meteorologists, such as myself, you're from down here too. You mm-hmm. know this area. We're now looking at potentially hundreds of deaths. And it gets to you, Jason. It really gets to you. I can tell you that the weather office at Austin, San Antonio, they did a great job. They did what they had to do. But they're devastated by this. There are people that are my friends now that I'm worried about at this point. Mm. And there are people in emergency management and rescue who I work with very closely that they are seeing things that Jason and Troy, I can trust me, you don't ever want to see. Mm. And so it's beyond the meteorology at this point, even for meteorologists. We are touched by this, especially in the Austin, San Antonio area. Because we know Kerrville. I mean, I've driven through there. I don't spend a lot of time in Kerrville, but at the same time, I know that area. I know the camps. I know the community. It's a great community of great people. And all they were trying to do, Jason, on a Thursday night, Friday morning, was go have fun for 4th of July. The kids going off to camp, their parents trusting camps to see that their children came home safely in a week. And we are where we are now. Yeah, I think it has a tremendous effect on people.
And Troy, in the background, as those people were going about their lives and just trying to enjoy their lives, in the background, there were people working hard. And we don't think about these people very often. We don't think about forecasters in an office somewhere nearby who are working diligently to figure out what's expected in the hours and days ahead. Let's go to that forecast, because so much was said about it, especially in those first days after this terrible tragedy. The forecast, let's start off with leading into July 4th, the days before we got to Friday morning. There were signs that something was brewing, and that forecast, as we got closer and closer to Friday, July 4th, started tightening up and sounding increasingly alarming.
Absolutely. And the flash flood watch that came out at 1 p.m. or shortly thereafter from the National Weather Service, Austin, San Antonio, the forecaster that issued it is a brilliant forecaster. And at the bottom, it said 4 to 7 inches of rain. And I'm hearing now people say, well, that it ended up being 10 to 15 or 18 inches of rain. Jason, you and I have both been around the hill country. 4 to 7 inches of rain in itself should be a heads up. And we know we're not going to be perfect with the forecast always going in. We're not going to be. We have to make readjustments. And besides that, I'll tell you now, if we had centered 10 or 15 inches, there'd be people arguing now that haven't had an inch. And so either way you look at it, you've got to look at what they put out to people. We talked about this. There is a responsibility in the general public. Weather Service cannot come out and hold your hand. And frankly, neither can emergency management. They depend on you having a plan. And you've got to be willing to take some action. All of the warnings, Jason, this is something not everyone knows. More and more people now know it. But there are three or four flavors of flash flood warnings. You have a basic one, you have a what we call a considerable tag, and then you have a catastrophic tag, you have the flash flood emergency. Those are the worst. Believe it or not, on these, on the WEA, that is part of the FEMA program that takes those bulletins, by the way, it's not a National Weather Service program, it's a FEMA program that mm-hmm. takes those warnings and transmits them to cell towers and they come to your phone. They don't alert in the base flash flood warning, Jason. That's just something they decided. I don't know why, but I'll tell you that years ago in Austin, San Antonio, in our county warning area of the National Weather Service, because of Flash Flood Alley, because of exactly what we've seen now, there was a decision that they would never issue base flash flood warnings for that reason, because it didn't go to WEA. Every warning they put out in the last week has been either considerable or above by a matter of office policy, and it's come to every one of these in those areas. But Jason, the last couple of days, I've had people come up to me and go, Troy, this thing's really starting to bug me. I'm going to turn them off. And I sit there and I shake my head and I say, I don't know that 100 or 200 deaths make a difference. I have to shake my head sometimes. If you're not getting the warning because you've turned something off on your phone, that's not the fault of the Weather Service. It's not the fault of emergency management. That's a personal decision you've made. You say, I've gotten no warning. That's on you.
And, you know, this should really focus our minds, shouldn't it? If we are one of those people who tends to turn those warnings off or disregard them and kind of turn the phone off because we want to go back to sleep, this should be a real wake-up call to all of us.
No question about it. We have Jason, Troy, everyone that's watching and listening to us needs to have a plan. I mentioned to someone, I have to give credit to my good friend, Kevin Klazel, meteorologist friend who does work here in Central Texas and used to be up at OU north of the Red River. One of his favorite sayings, Jason, is that hope is not a plan. Hope is not a plan. We do a lot of hope. I had someone mention to me this morning, well, I hope this doesn't happen again. Damn it, I don't want to depend on hope. Show me that we develop plans. That's what we've got to do. We can't, if we are supposedly a learned and civilized civilization, we've got to learn from this. Now, I will tell you this, and I agree with our first responders with boots on the ground in Kerrville and also on the northwest side of Austin right now. Our primary thing right now is we've got to do what we can to help to complete families and recover. That recover is the big deal right now. And that is a huge deal now with what the governor told us yesterday. Mm-hmm. But once we get on the other side of this, Jason, we're going to have to sit down and have a very painful discussion about what did or didn't work. We've got to find, I'm not saying we got to find guilt necessarily, but we've got to find out what went wrong. And something went wrong here.
Yeah. When people talk about, hey, you know, we shouldn't be blaming, we shouldn't be, you know, these questions are not fair, blah, 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 blah. My reaction to that is always, how do we learn from something if we don't ask those questions? And they are hard questions and they don't feel good. And, you know, some people might feel blame, but at the end of the day, you've got to prevent something terrible like this from happening again. There have been a lot of contentious media briefings and news conferences here as people have been asking questions, and there are legitimate questions. What questions do you want answered as an expert who's been in this a very long time? What questions do you have that you would like to see answered at the end of this?
What I would say is, it appears to me, I'm ready for someone to prove me wrong. I think the National Weather Service process worked, and I know that they hit the button on that console and sent those warnings out to weather radio, to the WEA, and everywhere else.
And that's what goes to wireless.
So we got that done. Something beyond that point failed, and whether it's at state level or local level, it's somewhere in there. It's not necessarily on the federal level, in my opinion. Now, may I be proven wrong at some point? And absolutely. I've that's happened before. But at the same time, I think the Weather Service did a very good job, and I stand by them. The men and women, Jason, that issued those warnings and those watches are all friends, and I would trust my life with them. I will tell you that. I know these people and everything else, but something failed beyond that, and we've just got to see. The questions that I would ask, if I were a reporter there, I would say, Can you see that we get copies of the, and that's, this is easy enough. The Kerr County, as well as the City of Kerrville Office of Emergency Management, get their emergency action plans. Those should be public record. But I'd also ask this, Jason, which I'm not hearing enough about. I want to see the plans on paper for every one of these camps that are along the rivers. And by the way, I'm talking not only about Kerrville now. I want to know about the rivers on the Llano River. I want to know about rivers in North Texas. If we have camps where you take your children and you entrust them to care and assume that a week later they'll be given back to you alive, if that's the case, if there are camps where we don't have emergency action plans, that is negligence.
Let me ask you this.
I would ask that. I would also ask, I'd like to know more, and I don't know more because I'm not in the position to ask for more, but I'd like to know what kind of communication there was between the National Weather Service and maybe the Office of Emergency Management there. Was there a phone call made? When was that received? I want to know the time that that was received, even at state level. I would like to know those sort of things. That's what I would ask now. And I'd say, please get that together so that when we finish this recovery process, we can begin to talk.
Something that I think touches on and furthers your point, a couple of the points that you just made there, is an article by the Associated Press that you shared out earlier this week. It's really interesting. It was talking about another camp there along the Guadalupe River called Mo Ranch, where they said in the article that the folks at that camp said that, you know, they didn't get a specific warning, but they had been plugged into the forecast. They had seen this forecast in the days before. They were watching that river. They were up late at night. And the first sign that they saw that that river was rising, they started actually proactively getting out there, rounding up their guests, even helping them to pack their things and telling them, you got to get out of here. We got to get you to higher ground. They got those people to higher ground. But what really struck me in that article, and everyone in that camp was safe at the end,
yes,
really struck me in that article, Troy, is something that you don't want to read in a case like this. It said that added to mounting accounts of how camps and residents say that they were left to make their own decisions in the absence of warnings or notifications from the county. You don't want to read something like that after this. You want it to go better than that. You want people to have a heads up, especially when these things strike in the middle of the night when so many people are sleeping.
And that was the big thing with this is you and I, we've worked together in places here in Austin where we know flash flooding, and this is North Texas as well, Dallas-Fort Worth. Most flash flood deaths occur at night when people cannot, just by the loss of daylight, they lose their situational awareness. 10 miles, 12 miles that way, Jason, we're looking for a volunteer fire chief that I know a little bit about and about his agency. And it's in the middle of the night. What was he doing out there? He was out trying to rescue someone. And we know that both his and the other vehicle have been found, but we've found, at least as of yesterday, no trace of those two. And, you know, again, at night, you've got to be that much more cautious. And I'll tell you something else that I think will be an attributing factor, and this one's not really debatable, is the fact we're going into the 4th of July. People are spinning down. All people are trying to do, in a lot of cases on the Guadalupe out there, if they're not at a camp, they're there just to kick back on the side of a gentle river and enjoy a great weekend in Kerrville. There's nothing wrong with that. I can't think of a better place I'd rather be. I saw a live shot, Jason, the last couple of days from a reporter about 8 o'clock in the evening, I guess, or 8:15. It was across the Guadalupe. The sun was low. The most beautiful view in the world. The sun's low in the sky. There's the river down below, and you kind of got beyond the piles of debris. And I said that, I mentioned during that live shot or an interview that I did, I said, that's what we know Kerrville for there. It's quiet behind that reporter at the moment, but we can only imagine what it was like at 5:36 a.m. last Friday morning.
We've heard a lot about how, you know, this happened so fast, you know, this water, it was a wall of water. It came, you know, in such a rush that it's hard to get people out and so forth. If we look at that morning of the flood, the alert that came out from the National Weather Service at 1:14 in the morning, it came with what they call a considerable tag. And you were talking about this earlier, which basically says this is significant. It's potentially life threatening. And this is a warning. So this is underway. It's happening. This is going out to cell phones and so forth. The Texas Tribune made a good point on this. They said that started the clock there. It gave 3 hours and 21 minutes from when the Weather Service sent out that warning to part of Kerr County and when they started getting those indications from low water crossings that the river was really rising. That's a good stretch of time. What should have been happening?
We know, Jason, one ranch took advantage of.
Yeah.
One camp took advantage of. And you know, if you don't hear something from someone, you get something like that. I even would stretch it back 15 hours before that, Jason, back to the watch. What are we supposed to do in a watch and a warning? I'm not sure we talked about this earlier, but you know, watch means to watch. It doesn't mean to change anything, but you need to, in your brain, kind of follow away. This is going to be a problem. Ooh, 4 to 7 inches of rain in the hill country. That's not good under any circumstance. I don't care how you look at it. They say, well, that was underestimated. 4 to 7 inches in the Texas hill country will kill you anyway, mm-hmm. in some cases. So, you know, I don't buy that from some of the state and local officials originally. I think some of the comments made on Friday were unfortunate, directed back to the Weather Service. You know, the flash flood watch means to watch. The warning means to act. Property or life threatening at 1:14 in the morning. And we know for a fact, Jason, that one camp did do that. And how many fatalities do they have?
Zero. You've been involved in emergency management over the years, Troy. You've been involved with emergency response over the years. In those 3 hours and 21 minutes from when that warning went out from the National Weather Service, in your professional estimation, best case scenario, what should have been happening in that period of time?
First flash flood warning came out, I'd be getting people away from that river. I would send, and I'm not talking about at 2 or 3 o'clock. I'm talking about at 1 o'clock. When that warning comes out, I would get people there anywhere close to the river. I'd start getting people out. And you got to realize that we're not only having to face that, the difficulty of doing that, but we're doing it when people are asleep. Mm. We've got to get people around where they realize the danger that's there. And we're waking people up in that process. And, I can only imagine what that was like. And we've got to find out. We got to have, I believe, Jason, we're owed a timeline of what happened in Kerrville that morning. I need to know what time police officers or people did this. I know they have code red in that county. I have read some things that I'm not real happy about in regard to that. And when and if that was activated. So, you know, these are things we can look at after recovery, but these are questions and answers that we must have if we care at all about what the cost that's come along with this. We can't have this happening. It's just not in 2025. It's not acceptable.
And you know, Troy, you mentioned the costs. We know that there have been efforts in the past to try to install sirens and so forth and a better warning system there along the Guadalupe River. In many cases, they considered the cost to be prohibitive. They couldn't get the grants, et cetera, et cetera. It never happened, even though, as you mentioned, this is Flash Flood Alley. We've seen it happen over and over again along that river. Now, though, it sounds like state and local are all on board, ready to get this thing done and try to get it done quickly.
I'd be willing to bet you, Jason, that Kerrville has a very robust flash flood alert system within 6 months. I don't think they can afford not to. And you and I both know, in this litigious world that we're in, that the courtrooms are going to fill up with time.
Mm-hmm. It would be wonderful to see them get that. It is terrible that it took this to make it happen.
Exactly.
Troy, you speak a lot with these National Weather Service folks. They're friends, they're colleagues. You mentioned that a lot of them are having trouble holding up right now. This is tough on them too. This is what they work to prevent. And yet, you know, here we are seeing these terrible images, these awful numbers. How's morale there?
I think morale is doing well. I think they just, I try to stay in touch with them once or twice every couple of days just to make sure my friends are doing okay. And, you know, this reflects back to a discussion that we previously had on this podcast. And your question was back then, you know, we have these Doge cuts, we have retirement cuts. Is that going to affect? If you recall in that interview, I told you the men and women of the National Weather Service, even with cuts, even with two positions down on forecasters down the road in Austin, San Antonio, and in a couple of leadership roles that are vacant, even with that, the program pushed on. They had five forecasters working that morning. So for anyone to tell me that short staff affected them that morning, that's a basic ignorance on whoever says that. I know there were five people in that office, but they surged staff to do that. Here's what I mentioned a couple of months ago. We can't afford to continue to do this. If we do surge staffing and we don't have personnel in place, we're going to burn the Weather Service people out. They're going to burn out.
Yeah, because after that terrible day, we've seen multiple more rounds of storms in that same area, too. You can't keep on, you know, essentially working people overtime.
No, and that's what I'm saying, because I still have people come to me and say, okay, you say that right now Weather Service in Austin, San Antonio is in pretty good shape. I think from a staffing standpoint, they are. They can show they can do the job in the most extreme case last Thursday night and Friday morning. But I'm telling you, I don't want to do that again next week or the week after next or the week after that. And you sit here and go, well, it's summer. Well, we're going into hurricane season. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with the National Weather Service office in our Dallas-Fort Worth area over in Fort Worth. We can't continue to keep the staffs and say, oh, it's working pretty good. It worked last week. The next one that rolls around, maybe some people out. I'm telling you, there were people in Austin, San Antonio that showed up off of leave, Jason. They were on leave. They weren't getting paid. They showed up. So, but I don't expect that is not good long term. That's what I'm saying.
It seems like you've retired from everything, Troy, but yet you're still the hardest working guy who's retired who I know. So you've been forecasting this past week. Who are you forecasting for?
I'm doing my work for the University of Texas for our Office of Security and Emergency Management. That hasn't required that all that much work lately. We've been pretty good on campus, but we also have other areas around the Austin area. We're in good shape there. Work also with the city of Kyle, Kyle Office of Emergency Management, south of Austin. That's within the great group of people in the Kyle Police Department. Work with Q2 Soccer. Love my work. We do that just to have a meteorologist in every emergency operations center activation we have for all matches. So I work with them. I'm doing my work. I'm a volunteer for Texar. I'm very proud of Texar. I don't know if you've heard of them or not.
Oh,
Texas
absolutely.
Search and Rescue. It's an amazing group of men and women, and they are the one who do all the work. I help them with meteorological stuff. I tell them when we've got rain or lightning around on activations. But this is a volunteer group statewide that goes out. No one gets paid. It's volunteer. It's supported, you know, just by people of the state and by various state agencies. And we respond anywhere within the state of Texas.
And they've been instrumental there in that Central Texas flooding and the search afterwards here.
Absolutely.
And so you're working with them, and obviously they've been dealing with some difficult weather conditions even as they're searching out there. Troy, I'll finish where we started here. You at one point there at UT Austin were teaching a class. It was an upper level class entitled Severe and Unusual Weather. And I'm just struck again by the fact that you say that this past week has been the hardest forecasting that you've encountered. What specifically is making it so hard?
You know, we've been having that discussion amongst meteorologists in this area, you know, about what's going right, what's going wrong. And everyone, it varies to some degree. Some people feel like they have a better handle on it. I haven't felt like I've had a best handle on it. It seems like the system started out as Tropical Storm Barry in the Gulf of Mexico, if you recall, and it went up on the coast of Mexico, well south of Brownsville. So it wasn't a big problem for Texas. And then it came up the eastern spine of the Sierra Madre Mountains of Mexico and ended up in the area out around Junction in southwest Texas. And it was thereafter that everything went to heck in a handbasket. And what we did, which was so unusual, for like 4 or 5 days, there were residual, Jason, it's hard to describe, but spin-ups. Just when we talk about spin-ups, we think about tornadoes. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about thunderstorms that would rotate, and they would sit in the same spot and produce these excessive rainfall amounts repeatedly. And we were dealing with that, and we were looking for these little spinning areas and trying to figure out what it was going to do. And then you went off and looked at some of the computer models that are supposed to help us, Jason, and you sit there and go, I just got where I shut them down. I said, I don't want to see that anymore. It's not helping me that much. And that's why I say at some point in the last week, there have been times when radar, to me, has been a forecast tool, and it really shouldn't be.
Yeah, because that's when it's happening.
That's when it's happening. But it got where it actually offered me more meaningful information sometimes than some of the models did.
That's interesting. You know, we worry about hurricanes a lot in this state. And over and over again, we have seen that it's the remnants of these tropical systems once they move inland, especially in the hill country, that can just be so devastating.
Yeah.
Troy, it's been a pleasure having you on. I know it's been a busy week. I know it's been a long week trying to help out with this. But I really wanted to have you here because, A, you speak clearly and plainly about these things, and B, you've touched on all parts of the equation here. Again, this isn't to cast blame on anybody. Yeah. And it's great that you have worked so closely over the years with different local governments. You've worked with first responders. You've obviously worked with National Weather Service. So it's like you've worked with all parts of the equation here. And again, we're not trying to point the finger at anybody. We're trying to figure out what went wrong here. And as you said, obviously multiple things have gone wrong here so that this never happens again.
Yeah. And that's where we have to as the Weather Enterprise. And by the way, the Weather Enterprise are people like in our weather office at the TV station in Dallas, Fort Worth. They're the people like private sector. They're people that are private sector meteorologists, consulting meteorologists. This is all the weather private sector. We're going to have to sit down with emergency management. We're going to have to sit down with the state of Texas emergency management. We have a great group of people at TDEM, at Texas Division of Emergency Management, do an amazing job in this state protecting the citizens and helping people to develop plans. And we have to go down to the local level and ask these questions as well. But let's pray and think about those people that have lost someone, and let's recover those people. Let's get the recovery out of the way, and then we are going to have to sit down and have a long talk.
Troy, thanks so much for doing this with us. Really appreciate it. Great to have you back on with us. Terrible to do it under these circumstances, though.
Yeah, I agree, and it's always good to see you, my friend.
Some important thoughts shared by Troy Kimmel, who has been in meteorology here in Texas for more than 4 decades now and has seen a lot. He has a lot of good questions, I think, there. We're bringing in Chris Lawrence now from WFAA-TV in Dallas to talk more about some of these issues that we just got into with Troy. Chris, you were down there. You handled the coverage for the station for those first several days of this awful tragedy. When did you head down after the flooding actually occurred there, especially in the Hunt and Kirk County area? And sort of what did you see when you first got there?
We went down last weekend, and the first thing I noticed was just the damage everywhere. I've covered a lot of hurricanes, tornadoes, and it reminded me of that. But over a
very wide area.
Much wider, obviously, than you'd see in a tornado. But just the sheer amount of damage with overturned cars and walls missing from homes and things like that.
And these gigantic trees in some cases, too, that have seen their share of floods, obviously, over the years.
Just not the kind of thing you're used to associating with flash flood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We should note here for people who aren't familiar, who are listening perhaps or watching from other parts of the state, we're well acquainted with you here, obviously. You've seen a few things. You were a national correspondent for a long time. You've covered wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You've seen a lot of really tough things to see. What was this like down there? Because you had such loss. I mean, this is a scale of loss that we're not accustomed to experiencing in this country when it comes to flooding. You hear about this in other places. We're not accustomed to this scale of loss, Chris.
No, and I think initially you didn't have that sense of the scope of this. I think so much was focused on Camp Mystic and mm-hmm. the children. And look, you're a dad, I'm a dad. Anytime you get a story in which you're talking about children have died, and in this case died in such a horrible way, that just adds another layer of sadness, just deep sadness. It wasn't really until days after where we learn, okay, we've documented this over 100 people who are dead. You're still looking for 170 more. So that was the big revelation to me, to say, wow, there are far more people missing than we've even accounted for as being deceased.
Yeah, it's staggering when you start putting these numbers together. And I think we all have had that moment of just almost shock as the days have gone by and those numbers keep moving, and they've been moving in the wrong direction. You know, we talk about so many children here, though, and as you mentioned, you're a dad. That hits differently, and it's a tough job to do. It's a tough job to even tell that story. And I imagine that you went through that, and we could see the same thing with some of these first responders, mm-hmm. with the local leaders, the state leaders, the federal leaders. You could see that it really hurts. We all feel this. It's visceral.
No, I mean, even, you know, when these officials get up there, a lot of them are politicians, or they're police chiefs, they're fire chiefs, they're people with a whole lot of experience, right? And people have been around the block a few times. And when you see them getting choked up, you can tell it's just a hard thing to comprehend. And mm-hmm. and I think especially because so many of us here in Texas, that's part of growing up, is you send your kids off to camp and mm-hmm. you hear the stories when they come back and all the things they did while they were at camp.
It's safe, it's fun.
Yes, yes, yeah. It's a way to get out and put your cell phone away and get out there and be by the river and be outside.
Get away from my parents, be with my friends,
exactly,
learn some new things,
get
some independence.
And I mean, you hear these stories about, you know, some of the parents were staying at a cabin upstream and hearing what had happened and trying to, I just can't imagine that, trying to get to your child and being totally unable to do so.
So much of this stays with you after you leave it. And I'm curious, just you heard a lot of stories there. You told a lot of stories from there. You bring a lot of that back with you. It stays with you.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things I think we really need to pay attention to is we really get focused on the deceased, and rightfully so, but I hope we don't lose sight of the survivors. Mm. Because when you hear, you know, a woman like in tears telling me she heard screaming outside, people screaming, and when she opened her door, the water rushed in on all sides, and her neighbor called to her, and she had a kayak, and she was trying to grab the kayak, and she had his hand slipped away from her, and he's hadn't been found. And like, these survivors aren't, they're not okay. Mm-hmm. They're not okay. Physically, mm-hmm. they may be in one piece, but mentally going through something like that is not something you just get over. And, you know, as the weeks and months, maybe even years to come, you know, when they're replaying what happened in their mind and you're thinking about the people who died and why I lived and could I have done more, what could I have done differently? I mean, they're going to need a lot of professional support to work through that.
I was going to say, some of that stuff that you're describing there, this woman, you know, losing that hand of someone that she's desperately trying to help, someone she knows.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that stays with you for the rest of your life. Yeah. Hearing someone screams out in the water and there's nothing you can do for them.
Yeah.
You know, we saw and read the stories about, you know, cars going down the river in the middle of the night. You could see the lights coming from the cars and you hear honking coming from the car.
They couldn't get out.
People who hear that, they will never forget that. It will stay with them in a very serious way the rest of their lives. And that's a great point that you make. We always see this surge of resources right after something happens, and then it sort of trickles away over time. And we've got so many people who are going to be left there who really need some scaffolding around them to hold them up long term. And not just the people who heard and saw things like you were describing there, but so many people have lost people they knew, people they loved, people they were friends with, neighbors, etc. This is going to take a long time to recover from.
Yeah, it could
if
be
ever,
it could
for
be
a lot
years.
Of people.
It very likely could be years.
Can you talk a little bit about the scale and the scope here? Because, you know, I think that, you know, people might assume that you get there, you get on the ground, you start, you know, recording video, you start telling people stories, you start interviewing people, you move around freely. It doesn't work that way. Was it hard to get wrap your arms around how much has been devastated there?
Yeah, well, especially because they, after I think about the first 36 hours, maybe 48 hours, they closed access to the main road. Mm-hmm. So you weren't able to get down to where some of the worst flooding was. And then DPS was on the scene and you'd get set up somewhere and a DPS cruiser would come by and say, no, you got to get away from there. You can't be there. And, you know, of course, we always, respected that. So you're trying to navigate that. How do I best find out what's going on to tell the story? And you're balancing, I want to be respectful of these first responders who are, you know, trying to secure the area. But at the same time, a lot of people have some real questions about what happened. And we can't just totally step back, hands off, and say, mm-hmm. okay, well, we'll just do exactly as you say. That's not how questions get answered.
It's interesting that you bring that up, Chris, because, you know, as someone who was watching these news feeds and the news conferences from day to day here, you know, and we can get into this a little bit, but you notice the tone and tenor of those news conferences changing as time went, as the questions became more pointed, as we really started to wrap our heads around what had happened and some of the things perhaps that may not have happened to get people out of harm's way or to warn people enough. It's one thing when those questions are coming from journalists, you know, and it's easy for leaders to, you know, say, hey, you know, and kind of take a tone. You're talking to regular people out there, though, on the streets. They were asking the same questions.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny. We, the last full day I was there, we went out with Governor Abbott and, you know, and the speaker as well was there, and some other officials, and they took us down into Hunt, and where the governor did his news conference. And I'll say two things. One, Governor Abbott's been around for a while. He's seen a lot.
Yeah.
He's an experienced politician. I could tell personally he was very emotional and shaken up. Mm-hmm. I've rarely heard that tremble in his voice. Mm-hmm. You could just tell, and when you see him up close, you can tell it's really affecting him. There was one analogy that I really didn't agree with, and someone asked him about when the warnings went out and were they communicated in a timely fashion. And he sort of likened it to a sports event, a game, where losers sort of assign blame, but winners look at what they can do differently. And to me, there's a difference between blame and accountability. Mm-hmm. And we're not looking to blame, but we have to look at accountability. And to just say, well, you move on, you find out what you can do better. Well, this isn't a game. It's the analogy would be if half the Dallas Cowboys collapsed on the field and died, do we just say, well, let's figure out what we can do better? Mm. Or do we start looking at medical records, training practices? Do we call the trainer in? Do we see what's in their system? Like, we scour the ends of the earth till we had those answers. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you're talking about so many people losing their lives, I don't know how you get to a place where you're making effective changes if you don't know where things went wrong, mm-hmm. or even if nothing went wrong, where they didn't go right.
You're right. Accountability is paramount, because even if you have systems in place, let's say you create new systems, let's say your old systems were good, but they just didn't work like they should have in this case, you've got to know where those weak links are. You've got to know where those people are who maybe, you know, didn't do the right thing, because the end result is you're trying to prevent something this horrible from ever happening again here.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, well, I think there's a couple things going on. It's, you know, first it was, well, we didn't get the forecast. We didn't, mm-hmm. the National Weather Service. But then we started to see, no, that these warnings were coming out.
That's, you know, the thing about those is that there's receipts.
There's
you can pull, yes. those warnings, and we did pull those warnings, yep. and those watches. And you saw that as the week progressed going into Friday, it started getting more and more pointed, more and more serious, more and more tailored. And yeah, it's still a wide area forecast, but you're starting to see language in there from the National Weather Service in the lead up to this that's suggesting that, hey, guys, everybody needs to really watch this. Let's pay attention here. And then the Texas Tribune had this headline that really stuck with me, and I hope I don't mess it up here. It was something to the effect of, you know, they sent out this flood warning, the National Weather Service did, 3 hours and 21 minutes before those gauges started showing the river just taking off. And what happened next, yeah. they asked. Yeah, and they're sort of breaking down, you know, what we know and sort of the what we don't know here too.
Yeah.
And there's a lot we still don't know.
No, and I think it's only natural that people want one person, one entity to say this was the cause of it. And I think the more time I spent down there and the more people I talked to, you start to see like this was more of a puzzle in which a lot of moving pieces came together to create this. I talked with Tom Moser, who was the retired commissioner, Kerr County commissioner, and he talked about, you know, 9 years ago, he got a 30, 40 stakeholders in a room, presented this proposal for an early warning siren system. He told me, like, at the time, the voters didn't go for it. You know, the voters looked at maybe it's a little too intrusive, it's a little too expensive, didn't want to spend the money. They applied for a federal
might
grant.
Might not want to hear the sirens
might
going
hear
off.
The sirens. The federal grant didn't get, they got rejected for the grant. And he said, look, we've received a lot of federal grants. We didn't get this one, so it didn't go anywhere. Maybe that's a piece. You look at these warnings were coming out, the local officials in Kerr County and Kerrville, maybe they didn't communicate to those camps as quickly as they could have. Was someone at the camp able to receive that immediately and immediately put a plan in place? So, you know, I don't know if there is going to be one thing you look at and you say, that was it. Mm. There may be a lot of moving pieces, things that happened over the years that created this, you know, perfect storm, for lack of a better term.
You mentioned the camps, and a lot of questions have been asked about these camps as well. So many of them have been around for so long, yeah. right there in the floodplain along this river that has proven over the years to be volatile and has proven to be a killer many times over. You have to imagine that could be something that comes up when the legislature meets in a special session. The governor's called that special session for later this month. You have to imagine that is one of the things that might come up in that session.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's fun. We get so many alerts on our cell phones now.
A lot of people ignore them.
I perfectly understand when you're getting an Amber Alert at 3 o'clock in the morning,
yep.
and it's from 400, 300 miles away.
Yep.
So you silence things like that. But I think, you know, something you mentioned, you'd have to have somebody just awake at all times, whether they've got a satellite phone or something that can immediately get communication so that they would know no matter what hour of the night, as soon as they get the word, they can implement a plan. But you know, when we talk about flash flood warnings all the time here in Dallas-Fort Worth, we see them all the time all over Texas. Normally you're telling people get off the road. Mm-hmm. You're not thinking a 30-foot wall of water that's gonna knock over a bunkhouse or tear people out of their homes. You're thinking get off the road, you don't wanna get caught, turn around, don't drown, that mm-hmm. things like that. So I do think there is the measure of the unprecedented here mm-hmm. In that even me, when I hear flash flood, I don't necessarily think of a danger to my home.
Right.
I think more, I don't want to be out on the road.
Right, and this really resets all of that. And it does tell you just how different things are when you're talking about being along a river like this, which is notorious, as we say, over the decades. It yeah. has proven it many times over. But we have to imagine that there will be focus on those action plans all the way down to the camp level. Because Chris, as horrible as this has been, you start putting together some of the numbers of people, of children in just one of those camps. I mean, we talk a lot about Camp Mystic and the horrendous loss that has happened there.
Yep.
There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of children at that one camp. This could, when you think about how much worse still this could have been.
Yeah.
I mean, that's staggering.
And the majority of people weren't registered with any group. It's like when my family and I, when we go camping, oh, let's go to Big Bend. Or where do you want to go? Okay, well, all right, this spot looks good. We're not telling anybody where nope. we're set up, that, but we go and we set up there. And so I think a lot of these people were just out camping along, you know, it's the 4th of July weekend. Let's go set up the tent. Let's go get a little cabin down by the river.
Mm-hmm. And let's not tell anybody, because, you know, you don't check in with anybody before you go on vacation sometimes.
No, if you look at the pictures, you look at the photos and images from 24 hours earlier, you know, there's people swimming in the river, you know, jumping in the river. It's a sunny day. It's beautiful out there.
You see these campers playing and singing, and it's heartbreaking to see. But, you know, to your point there, that's why we've seen that number swell of the number of unaccounted for, because at first it was, you know, people who were registered and we knew that they were missing. And then we started getting these reports from families and friends of other people who haven't heard from them. And the last they knew, they were kind of going to go into that area and maybe put up a tent somewhere. The last thing that we'll get into here, well, before I get to that, I want to ask you, did you notice that change, though, that we were talking about with the news conferences, with the tone of this as things went and as these questions got sharper? And what is your feeling about how we and how quickly will we maybe get the true answers here?
I think it was only natural, because when you hear of something that shocking, you're trying to get a handle on what just happened here. Like what, mm-hmm. who died? What, mm-hmm. how, what happened? And I think it took at least a couple of days just to process that, what happened at Camp Mystic, what happened to these other people. And they start to get some idea of what happened. Once you have an idea of what happened, people started retracing the steps, mm-hmm. started, okay, from the moment that storm hit, let's start looking at what happened in the minutes, in the hours, in the days, in the years leading up to that. Mm-hmm. And I think as you started to pull that string, things came into focus to say, wait a minute, you know, these warnings came out. Who listened to those warnings? Who did they pass those warnings on to? Who received those warnings? And if they received those warnings, what did they do mm-hmm. at that point?
Mm-hmm. So that'll continue now. Hopefully we do get all of the answers, a full report here, because only when you have the information do you know how to not do this again. My last thing is, you know, we've had this special session called, as I said. It's devastating when you talk about, over the years, the sirens, the warning systems, being knocked down and you know, people basically saying we don't have the money or we don't support mm-hmm. that, and it never got done, and that it takes something this horrible to bring that about. But did you get a sense, though? I mean, I got a sense just as a viewer watching from, you know, DFW, these news conferences and so forth. Did you get a sense from officials and from people in the community that this now has that critical mass to finally happen?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Moser, the former Clark County Commissioner, mentioned that. He said, look, right now you've got the whole world's attention. This is a unique moment in time to get something done. And he was hoping that this might be a catalyst to, you know, let's cut through the red tape. We're not going to worry about the money. We're going to get the system that maybe, and again, this may be a system that maybe they fund in the special session and it gets installed in the next year or so. Maybe it doesn't pay off for 50 years, 60 years. A lot of the people who implement this system may be long gone by the time it's truly, truly needed. But that's the nature of weather in Texas. You don't know. It could be a normal flash flood for the next 4 or 5 decades, and then you get another big one.
Or this thing could pay off next year.
Or next year. You just don't know.
That's the thing, though, is it's odd how it takes something this terrible to train our thoughts and focus us and make us not as concerned about a price tag as we've been for all of these years to finally make progress. It takes such tragedy to move us sometimes. But hopefully something does get done this time, because we can't see something like this happen again. Chris Lawrence, I know it's been a long and emotional week. It's emotional being close to something like this. So thanks for debriefing with us here and making us smarter on some of this stuff. Really appreciate having you.
Thanks, Jason.
And thank you for listening and for watching. We are back next week with another edition of Yolitics.